Millions of voters across 16 states and American Samoa cast their ballots in the Super Tuesday primary yesterday. The results were pretty much what we expected. But as New Yorker staff writer Ben Wallace Wells points out, there are a few important things to watch as primary season wraps up. First, I'll talk to him, and then to Antonia Hitchens, who had a front row seat to Mar-a-Lago's election night watch party. You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. So, Ben, there was a lot of talk going into the primaries last night about how this year's Super Tuesday wasn't actually that super. There were some interesting down-ballot races, but if anything, when it came to the, you know, presidential primaries, it seemed like this was just going to be confirming some inevitabilities. And so I'm wondering, I mean, what were the most significant things that happened last night?
I think the most significant thing is we can now see the next 8 months of presidential race clearly. Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee. Nikki Haley has now suspended her campaign. And Joe Biden will be the Democratic nominee. And Donald Trump is leading Joe Biden. Just about, you know, every poll that you look at has the Republican slightly ahead. So, you know, there are other races to discuss and other dynamics. But I think the top line coming out of Super Tuesday is we can see what the next 8 months are going to look like. And it is, I think, going to be a pretty tense run up to the election.
So let's talk briefly about Haley real quick. As you mentioned, as of this recording, it looks like Nikki Haley is going to be suspending her campaign. Trump basically trounced her last night, although she did win the Vermont Republican primary. How would you characterize the effect of Haley's primary race on Donald Trump's campaign? Like, did her staying in the race for so long have any kind of impact?
I think a lot of people had hoped it would, had hoped that there would be a, you know, a kind of biggish group of Republicans who were skeptical of Trump, who maybe adhered to kind of an older vision of the party. But I think when we look back, it's hard to see a big effect. You know, Haley was not a bad candidate, but her line against Donald Trump was often meek. She said, you know, he's chaotic again and again, which is certainly true. But she didn't really go after him on January 6th. She didn't take a sharply critical line against him. She, like a lot of the other candidates who dropped out before her, I think was deferring to the polls and looking at a party where, you know, the bulk of the electorate, you know, was enthusiastic about Donald Trump, thought the 2020 election had been stolen, wanted the country to move in a deeply conservative direction, and was fundamentally kind of unwilling to go up against that vision of the Republican base or present a sort of strongly contrasting vision. And, you know, I think she sort of fits in with a lot of other Republicans over the last 5 years, you know, Mitch McConnell, you know, on down, who have sort of, you know, understood some of what was dangerous about Trump, and even at times sort of stood up to him, but just sort of fundamentally been unable or unwilling or some overlap of the two to make a really strong anti-Trump case. So I think we can take from Haley's campaign that there is some part of the Republican electorate that is still uncomfortable with Trump. But I think we can also take that, you know, maybe it's a little smaller than we might have thought. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit less antagonistic towards Trump than we might have assumed. So, you know, she has said that she's only suspending her campaign. She's not going to endorse Trump. Presumably that just sort of means that she's trying to wait out some of the trials, though I think that's a little bit of a fool's errand, and see if his candidacy sort of collapses on its own. But, you know, I don't think in the end this was a very impactful campaign.
So moving to the Democrats, would you say that Biden had a good night? I know that he's running unopposed, basically, so maybe it's a weird question, but it's also starting to seem like things might not be that straightforward for him.
It's definitely beginning to seem like things might not be that straightforward for him.
Yeah.
I don't think last night was terrible for him. You know, there was the kind of alternative to Biden is basically voters voting uncommitted, which is something that does often happen in campaigns. you know, Barack Obama had some uncommitted votes against him in 2012. And in Michigan, which was something that, you know, a state that a lot of people had been watching a week ago, there was a sizable uncommitted vote. I think it ended up over 10%, but below 20.
Yeah. 100,000 primary voters in Michigan.
Not a small number of people. Obviously, a very large Arab American community in Michigan, and particularly Palestinian American. And, you know, that vote was a lot of organization to try to vote uncommitted against Biden as a protest against the Israel-Gaza war and Biden's support of Israel in that war. In Minnesota last night, there was a sort of similarly sizable vote. I do think that that is a narrow issue for Biden that, you know, he will have to deal with through these next few months.
How do you think he's actually going to deal with it? Because these uncommitted delegates go to the convention, but they're only going to be a handful of them compared to all of the delegates who are for Biden. And so how do you see the uncommitted movement like actually affecting his campaign and his messaging going forward? Like, how much does he actually need to pay attention to it?
I don't know that the uncommitted movement is something that will cause him big practical problems at the convention. I do think the fact that, you know, many voters who in 2020 were in his base on a number of issues across a range of demographic categories now view him skeptically or negatively is a huge issue for him. He eked out a win over Trump in 2020 with an approval rating in the mid-50s. Now his approval rating is in the high 30s. It's an extraordinary number of Americans who used to say they thought highly of President Biden and now say they don't. Not to throw a ton of polling data at you here, but among voters under 30, which I think is correctly seen as being one place where there's some sympathy for the Palestinian sort of position. Biden won last time in 2020 by something like 25 points. A big Fox News poll a couple days ago had him trailing Trump among voters under 30. That's not because a ton of, you know, 26-year-olds have said, you know what, I'm done with liberalism. I'm all in for Trump. It's because a lot of those voters who a few years ago would have said, Biden's my guy, are now saying, pretty disinterested in this whole thing. I don't see anybody who's speaking to me. I may just sit this one out. Not to layer too much on here, but, you know, among women, you know, he won by 10 points last time. Now it's about even. Among Latino voters, same deal.
The women thing seems impossible to me. Like, I saw that. Was that the New York Times poll?
Yeah.
I saw that and was kind of like, really? I guess that's a larger question about all the different polls and what they show and whether we can trust them. I mean, I think we all still have PTSD over the New York Times election needle from 2016.
Yeah, I mean, you know, good questions. And, you know, we'll see what happens going forward. But every poll we've seen for many months now has picked up just a general decay in Biden's support. That, you know, high 30s approval rating is really bad. And that is going to not just come from like a whole lot of white men turning against him. It's going to come from, you know, people in voting groups that he used to win comfortably saying, I don't know.
So, Ben, I'd like to talk more about the general election and also dive into some political issues that you've been tracking. But first, we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment. If you've been enjoying the show, please leave us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. And while you're there, don't forget to hit the follow button so you never miss an episode.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So, Ben, we've talked a bit on this show about the potential impact of third-party candidates on a primarily Trump versus Biden general election. It looks like Haley has ruled out a third-party run, but I'm wondering if there's anyone else who you could see complicating the race in some kind of significant way.
The margins are so small, so tight between how voters think about Democrats and Republicans and, you know, even between Trump and Biden right now, that almost any third-party run could complicate things. So, you know, there are polls right now that have Robert Kennedy up over 10%, you know, at 14%. Do I think that that will hold through November? I'd be really surprised. But if he's, you know, able to get on the ballot in enough places, you know, Ralph Nader plausibly threw the election to George Bush in 2000, you know, we're in a place where it doesn't take a lot. I have not heard, I do not see any major political figure stepping in as a third party candidate right now. You know, there's a lot of talk for a while about Joe Manchin. He also recently ruled out a third party run. Liz Cheney, who had been discussed earlier, you know, has not emerged as a presidential candidate. It just doesn't take much. You know, we're like right on the line here. And, you know, there's a huge amount of discontent with both candidates. So does this feel like a place where protest votes, you know, low voter turnout might drive the outcome of the election? Absolutely. You know, for reasons that are sometimes hard to like fully comprehend, it seems a very cynical electorate and a very close race. And so, sure, a third party candidate could absolutely make the difference. But I don't think it's like, you know, I don't think there's somebody out there who's gonna win the election, who's gonna step into the ring. I think it's more a question of do, you know, 50,000 votes in a couple of really pivotal states go to somebody who's not Biden or Trump. And I think there's absolutely a possibility of that.
So primary voters cast their ballots in Texas yesterday, which, you know, has obviously become the center of a larger political debate over immigration. Both Trump and Biden recently visited border towns there after Congress failed to pass immigration reform. Where do you think that the Biden campaign needs to go in order to go toe-to-toe with Republicans on immigration? And do they even want to go toe-to-toe with Republicans on immigration?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's still primarily a base issue for Republicans. I think that it's something that, you know, Biden would primarily not want to talk about. But I think the reason it's been effective in this campaign is that the Republicans have been able to say, you know, look, this is chaos, in the same way that they were able to look at, to draw people's attention to the pullout from Afghanistan and say, look, there is chaos here. You know, Biden is, you know, very old. The vast majority of Americans think he's too old to be president. And, you know, the Republican line has not just been, we've got to change policy to build more fencing and walls and deploy more military, though they have said that, you know. It's been that Biden can't handle this. And so, you know, there is an element of Biden sort of trying to run to the center. The immigration package he was pushing towards before Trump encouraged Republicans to torpedo it was much more pro-enforcement than the administration's policy had been earlier. But I think the deeper problem for him is just being able to reassure Americans that things are not out of control, that he has a handle on what is happening, that if he says we want fewer people coming across the border, he can actually achieve that.
I see. I mean, that actually explains things a bit, like that it's more a show of competency than anything, just because I feel like, you know, we were talking about the uncommitted voters earlier, and obviously a lot of them are progressive and they are voting uncommitted because they're concerned about Israel. And it seems like going hard on immigration would risk further alienating the same people who are concerned about U.S. support for Israel and its war against Hamas.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's another element here, which is through his whole presidency, it seemed like Biden is fighting through a kind of reputational sludge. You know, like you can look at the policy and you can say like, this is like working pretty well. Like inequality's down, you know, the economy's booming. And yet, you know, over the last few months, the economy has really looked quite strong in a very encouraging way. And yet it hasn't budged Biden's poll numbers upwards a bit. In fact, they're kind of getting worse. And so you look at that and you say, like, well, what is in the background here? And the thing that voters keep saying, and this is people who are attentive to politics and people who are totally inattentive to politics, is the guy's too old. And to me, when I talk to voters, what I really hear them saying is, like, I don't trust him to solve problems. If the data says, you know, the economy is getting better, I don't believe that that's Biden who's responsible. When I look at images from the border and I think that looks out of control, I think that must have something to do with the fact that the guy at the top is over 80 years old. And so I do think that there are obvious sort of policy or ideological dimensions to the immigration issue, as there are to all of these issues. But a fundamental thing that I think Biden has really struggled to impress upon voters is that when good things are happening in the country, he's responsible for them. And when bad things are happening in the country, he's not responsible for them.
Well, that's a great segue into this next question. So the State of the Union is tomorrow, and I'm wondering what you think Biden needs to do in that address, aside from put on a Ronald Reagan-like, you know, performance and show of charisma and vitality despite being old.
That would be quite a turn. You know, look, I think that things are shifting a little bit in the presidential race. The Trump campaign has been very effective at keeping Trump basically off stage, you know, for most of this election.
Yeah.
He didn't participate in any of the debates. He hasn't done a ton of big events. He is on Truth Social, which like nobody can read, you know, rather than Twitter, right? Where the audience would be bigger. And, you know, people don't like Trump any more than they did before the 2020 election. They just like Biden a lot less. Last night at Mar-a-Lago, Trump gets up there and gives, you know, the kind of speech he's been giving to small audiences for the last year, which is to say, it sounds kind of crazy. You know, he says America's becoming a third world country. He rants about the cases against him. You know, it's pretty meandering. He goes home. It's just a reminder that, you know, there is another bad candidate in this race for Biden to draw people's attention to. So, you know, I think that what the Biden White House would love to do is brag about the economic success. But to me, you know, people will either see the economy as working for them or they won't. What he's really got to do in this address and in this next phase of the campaign, I think, is remind people, you know, what a threat Donald Trump poses, why he would be a worse president than Biden, and just give a like clear sense of the contrast and the stakes in this election. And you can say, man, that sounds a lot like what Hillary Clinton tried to do in 2016. Sounds like what Biden did in 2020. But it's probably the best play that the Democrats have. It's a thing that's worked for them in midterm elections and last time around. You know, people still really don't like Donald Trump. And, you know, many of them are pretty scared of him. And to remind a voter who might think Biden has gone in too hard for Israel in the war, but also is really worried about, you know, reproductive rights, exactly what is at stake in this election, exactly the way that Republicans want to take the country, to maybe incur some like loud booing from Republicans, I don't think would be a bad thing for Biden. So, you know, I think what he needs to do is be sharp and be prickly and not try to convene a consensus, but point out, you know, why his version of the union is better than Trump's.
I wanted to ask you about this tweet that I saw from Kamala Harris yesterday. Maybe you saw it too. For listeners who didn't get the pleasure of coming across it on their feeds, it was a photo of Kamala walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge with text that said, "History is a relay race. Generations before us carried the baton. Now they have passed it to us." As you can imagine, this prompted a bunch of speculation that Harris will be replacing Biden at the convention. You know, it was the combination of the quote and the timing of the tweet. Do you have any reason to think that this is going to happen? I mean, was last night that bad for Biden?
No. No, I don't. I don't think there's any reason to think that Harris or even really another Democrat is so much more popular than Biden that it is worth for Democrats risking losing the advantage of incumbency and risking just the general impression of chaos and failure that necessarily accompanies sort of yanking the existing president and somehow replacing him with a different candidate. I also think just basically, because there's been a lot of speculation about this, politicians are, you know, they're kind of bent people off. You know, they're generally pretty narcissistic. You know, it's a weird thing to stand up in front of a crowd of people and say, you know, I am the person to lead you. It takes a particular personality. Most of them think that what they have to offer is really unique and really different from anybody else who might vote with them, you know, 100% of the time. You listen to their stump speeches, and it's often, and this is especially true with Biden, you know, it's often very personal. It's about how they came to their politics through childhood experiences and, you know, experiences in young adulthood. And, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for the good of the Democratic Party, probably should have resigned when Obama was president. She didn't. Biden might have done the Democrats some good if he had said at the outset, you know, I'm not going to run for a second term. And, you know, here's the person, whether it's Harris or somebody else, who will. There's a case being made that Sonia Sotomayor should step aside now and, you know, wouldn't be a bad thing for Democrats to have a big fight over, you know, reproductive rights in the Supreme Court in the middle of an election year. Those are probably issues from which they benefit, but they don't do it, you know. And I think it's maybe a little naive and somewhat against the character of politicians to expect them to. And, you know, in this case in particular, every time I've heard from a Democratic operative or elected official who's worrying over the election, says, my God, you know, it just, if he just wouldn't run, you know, the question I tend to ask them is like, well, how will that happen? You know, who is, if he wants to run, who is going to convince him not to? You know, I just think that vision of like a set of party elders who have the power and influence to just instruct the president of the United States what to do, it just doesn't exist.
Well, thank you so much, Ben. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. Take care.
After the break, Antonia Hitchens on what it's like to be at Mar-a-Lago on election night.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, Antonia. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So you were at Mar-a-Lago last night for Trump's victory party, and I honestly don't know whether I envy you or whether I pity you. I think I envy you, honestly. But what was the reaction to Nikki Haley winning Vermont, like among the crowd there?
I don't know if the crowd even registered that. I would say in the ballroom at Mar-a-Lago, it was sort of a sanctuary where it was almost as though Trump had become president again already. I don't think much attention was paid to, you know, that small symbolic victory, even though she sent out an email, you know, about the historic significance of being the first female Republican to win the state. That was not being noted at Mar-a-Lago, for better or worse.
So what was being noted? I mean, can you just tell me more about what you saw and heard throughout the night? Just like kind of paint a picture.
Sure. I think in the ballroom, starting at about 4 p.m., Trump had invited local people who support him, and they were bussed in from a hotel nearby. And then there were also kind of mainstays you see always at Trump events. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene was circulating and taking photos and doing TV hits. We had members of the Trump campaign, kind of senior officials, coming out and talking to the press. And the mood was sort of that of a coronation. You know, they didn't want anybody to be thinking about something that wasn't a victory for them. And in the ballroom, for the most part, since people were pretty sure Trump was going to win every state, as he won states and they were announced, there was applause and there was cheering, but there wasn't a lot of tension or suspense. There was a feeling that it was kind of already in the bag and they were just there to unite the party and move on and just focus on, in their words, beating Joe Biden in November.
Did you talk to anyone especially interesting?
There was a real mix. There was Moms for Liberty. There were Bikers for Trump. There were some, you know, pretty unidentifiable volunteers and just incredible Palm Beach cookbits who were drinking cocktails and eating coconut shrimp. So it was a very, there was a nice ambiance to the event, all in all.
There's something kind of funny about an election results party that presumably has a decent amount of election deniers in the room. You know, to what extent were people talking about the idea that the polls are rigged, and even though Trump is going to be the Republican candidate for president, that he's probably not going to win because even if he does get more votes than Biden in the general, those votes won't be counted. I mean, was that something that people were talking about? Was that in the air at all?
In my experience last night, that didn't seem to be a concern just yet. For those who were there who did believe in the election results, I think there was a feeling of defiance that they wanted to move on from 2020 and just focus on kind of winning this fall against Joe Biden. There wasn't yet a feeling of kind of conspiratorial, it's going to be taken from us, nothing's going to be fair. The mood was actually, I think, one of optimism in the former president being able to win. It was more when Trump himself came out to make remarks that I think he focused much more on the past and how it hadn't been fair and nobody gave him credit. And it was sort of a much darker view than perhaps there was in the ballroom in the hours leading up to his arrival.
To what extent were people talking about Trump's trials and his general legal troubles last night? Did people seem worried about the legal cases against Trump?
No, and I think the fact that it seems unlikely any of those will be resolved by November for them is another thing to celebrate. They were celebrating on Monday that Colorado, you know, has to keep him on the ballot. And there was a feeling on Tuesday that the legal cases are something that the left is preoccupied with, but that don't really have any meaningful impact on what's going to happen to him.
Going back to Trump's victory speech, I mean, it seems like it was pretty somber. And I'm wondering what you think that was about.
Inclusive. This was an amazing night, an amazing day. It's been an incredible period of time in our country's history.
I was very surprised by the tone of his speech. I'd most recently seen him at rallies in Iowa, for example. He did what he calls a two-hour beauty, where he just sort of riffed for 2 hours or more, and he's smiling and he's imitating Joe Biden, not being able to find the stairs. And he really can capture a crowd's attention in a way that is pretty unique. It was very different in Mar-a-Lago. It felt a little bit more formal and stuffy. And he barely mentioned the victories of the evening. He focused much more on, you know, the country's destroyed by Biden. He spoke a lot about immigration, but there wasn't really a sense of unification and excitement about the future that I heard from people attending the party. And, you know, people were filtering out because they were bored, because they were kind of these scripted political remarks that went on for not more than 15 minutes. And I don't think it was the show that people generally wait 7 or 8 hours to see from Trump. Many people got there at 4 p.m. and they were waiting until 10 p.m. because they said, you know, Trump is such an incredible presence in person. And I think last night that was a bit of a letdown, even to reporters. You know, people were yawning and not as captivated as they sometimes can be.
I know you're not a psychiatrist, but why do you think Trump was acting like that last night? I mean, do you think it has something to do with the Stormy Daniels trial is coming up later this month? I mean, what is it that resulted in that mood from him?
I definitely wouldn't want to psychoanalyze Trump. We speak often about Biden's frailty in the sense that, you know, for example, leading up to the State of the Union, he has very few things on his schedule because he's preparing for that large event. Trump has been flying to court, to rallies, to Mar-a-Lago. He was over the weekend at a puppy auction Laura Trump was doing. There's just a sense that you saw him at a moment where it felt like the road had sort of run out. I don't think it is speaking to a broader sense of he's become disillusioned. I think it was a mood that perhaps was, he was saying, I'm at home, I'm among friends, I can speak this way. It's not a rally where he has to kind of rile people up to feel as though, you know, we have to take the country back. He knew he was among supporters who perhaps he felt a bit more comfortable with.
That's fascinating that you're able to get a front row seat to that. You were able to see the real Trump, it sounds like.
No, and he walked out and he generally likes to come over to the press and engage in whatever way he feels like. And last night he just walked out a couple of waves a smile that, you know, I saw it leave his face when he was done doing it for the camera, and he was off up the stairs by, you know, 10:45. And that was that. The buses were filled with people going back home. The event was over. I actually drove home just behind Chris La Civita and Jason Miller, who had told reporters they were just totally exhausted. So it was a sort of poignant moment of honesty from the campaign about, we've worked really hard, and, you know, we have to keep fighting because November is a long time away.
Well, on that inspiring note, I think we can close. Thank you so much, Antonia. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Benjamin Wallace Wells and Antonia Hitchens both report on politics for The New Yorker. You can read their latest pieces at newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter, with editing from Stephanie Karayuki and mixing by Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
From PRX.